You have 15 minutes. Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal, please.
Two. That would be two.
Two minutes.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine French and I represent Mr. Eggleston. It seems that both the Commonwealth and myself, that the law is clear that the parole board absolutely has the authority to revoke and recommit.
If only it were clear.
Pardon me?
If only it were clear.
I think that the real issue comes down to whether the trial court shares in that power of the parole board. And, of course, our position is that it is not. It's only the parole board's authority.
Can I ask you about a procedural matter before we
sure.
get into the merits of it? Apparently, there's three different statutes we have to harmonize here. Let me start with 18.2-10, which says that for any felony committed after July 1st, 2000, the court shall impose an additional term of not less than 6 months nor more than 3 years, which shall be suspended conditioned upon successful completion of a period of post-release supervision pursuant to 19.2-295.2 and compliance with such other terms as the sentencing court may require. So that statute clearly does two things, it seems to me. One is it requires it permits the circuit court to set terms and conditions of the post-release supervision. Parole board can do the same thing, so we've got certainly congruent authority there. But the first part of it requires that the court impose an additional term of from 6 months to 3 years, which is then suspended and becomes the sword hanging over the inmate's head so that after his release he's required to follow whatever those terms and conditions are upon pain of having that additional time executed against on him. That was not done in this case. There was no additional sentence imposed. So what effect does that have on our decision here? I mean, we typically don't decide things that are meritless, that are useless, that have, no legal effect. And here, there is literally nothing to be done, assuming your client did violate the terms and conditions.
I would say, and I'm willing to assume without conceding, that when you have a suspended term of post-release supervision, that necessarily encompasses, and I want to be careful with the words, a suspended term of incarceration. And I think that there's the Thomas case that's recently, it's an unpublished opinion that came out of this court, I believe in April, that kind of recognize that where you have a suspended term or post-release supervision, in order to give it any kind of meat or effect, that necessarily encompasses a suspended term of incarceration. So I'm willing to assume that that's correct. And if that's correct, when you look at 19.2-295.2b and 19.2-295.2:1b, where they're both statutes regarding post-release supervision, the one with the colon one at the end, that has to do with failure to register as a sex offender. And it is clear that the legislature said, well, if post-release, that who can revoke and recommit, that it's a trial court pursuant to 306.
But there's nothing to revoke here. The sentencing order says the defendant shall be subject to a period of post-release supervision of 3 years pursuant to 19.2-295.2, but it does not impose any additional time to be executed for a violation of that. In other words, the trial court didn't do what it was required to do under 18.2-10, so I guess my question is, where does that leave us?
We don't give advisory opinions.
I do think that even though 18.2-10G wasn't specifically invoked, that just by the very fact of imposing a suspended term of incarceration. And when you look at the transcript was from the trial court judge, a suspended term of post-release supervision / incarceration. When
but
you go
where
back
in
to the
orders,
transcript.
Where in the orders does it
I think
that?
it's necessarily implicit.
But here's the problem I have with that analysis. And I don't want you to sell your client down the road here either, but I'm going to be very careful with how I phrase this. But the General Assembly is very careful in all three of these statutes to distinguish between a sentence and post-release supervision. So it seems to me post-release supervision is separate and apart from the actual sentence for whatever the crime was you were convicted of. And if that's the case, and it certainly seems to be the case since 18.2-10 requires that in addition to the sentence imposed, the court impose this additional time to be suspended from 6 months to 3 years to be suspended based on whatever conditions of post-release supervision it also imposes. And that wasn't done. So all we have here is an order that orders post-release supervision of 3 years pursuant to 295.2. And assuming, I mean, I think, you know, your client's in a position, I'm not sure you're making this argument, I really don't want to put you on the spot, but it seems to me one obvious argument is it doesn't matter if he violated any of those terms and conditions because there's nothing the court can do about it because it isn't part of the final order. And the court has now lost jurisdiction over that case.
Well, if you want to say that that was a void order...
Well, it's not void. It's just no part of the order is any sentence to be imposed for violation of post-release supervision conditions pursuant to 18.2-10. It was just left out.
So I think if that was taken to its logical conclusion, that would mean that every single order that ordered post-release supervision would... also, not just referring to 19.2, 295.2b would have to specifically refer to 18.2-10g.
Well, I don't know if it would necessarily have to specifically refer to it, but it certainly should do what 18.2-10 says the court has to do, which is to actually impose some additional time to be suspended conditioned upon whatever the post-release supervision conditions are.
And I go back to, I think that that's encompassed, and that's why I was very careful to say a suspended term of incarceration and not a suspended sentence, because I do think that there's a difference. And I'm going to throw another statute, which I apologize because I found it last night, but I think that it is helpful for this court, so I apologize to counsel, is 19.2-303.1. And that statute says, in any case where a court suspends the imposition or execution of a sentence, it may fix the period of suspension for a reasonable time. That phrase, in any case where a court suspends the imposition or execution of a sentence, like what you have, very similar, in 19.2-306, in any case in which a court has suspended the execution or imposition of a sentence, I think the phrase when you're talking about a suspended sentence versus that specifically suspended the execution or imposition of a sentence is different than a suspended term of incarceration that's naturally encompassed within a suspended term of post-release supervision. And going back to 303.1, it shows that 306 cannot apply here because otherwise in 303.1, the second part of it is that when a court suspends the imposition or execution of a sentence, it may fix the period of suspension for a reasonable time. And here, the statute is clear in 19.2-295.2 that it could only be a maximum of 3 years. So that shows me that the legislature took care to say that there's a difference between suspending the imposition or execution of a sentence and a suspended term of post-release supervision, which necessarily includes a suspended term of incarceration. So that's another reason why.
Well, here's my problem. I get your argument that there's an implication here, but it's an implication I don't think is supported by the language the General Assembly actually uses. For example, in 19.2-295.2, the court says as follows. I'll see if I can paraphrase it here. In addition to any other punishment imposed, if such other punishment includes an active term of incarceration, the court shall impose a term of post-release supervision of not less than 6 months nor more than 3 years, as the court may determine. And so it seems to me the General Assembly is saying, in addition to any other punishment imposed, in other words, in addition to the sentence the court can impose this. It's not part of the sentence. It's in addition to it.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, if it's not part of the sentence, and I think the General Assembly in all these statutes is careful to say, you know, to use language which suggests that it's not part of the sentence, it's in addition to it, that the court has to do something, and it obviously makes sense. If you're going to impose post-release supervision conditions where they serve their sentence in effect, you've got to have something hanging over their head. And here there's nothing hanging over your client's head.
I think that even though that language says that, I do think that the order does not have to specifically say, refer to 18.2-10G.
But it has to use that language, though. I mean, it's the carrot-stick thing. You've got to have the ability, if you're going to add these extra conditions and there's no sentence left, there has to be the ability to say, okay, you failed to do that, so now here's what happens. And like Judge Humphrey said, you may not need to write to enter the code section into the order, but there's got to be some time there.
Well, I think then you go back to the transcript. The order doesn't contradict what the transcript
said. Well, the courts speak through their orders.
But if there's something in the transcript that clearly, it doesn't contradict the order at all. It's just showing that it's a little bit more, that it's an addition. And I think the clear intent, and even when you look at the order, that
What was imposed here for post-release supervision? What's your position as to what the court imposed here, separate and apart from the actual sentence for post-release supervision?
The defendant shall be subject to a period of post-release supervision of 3 years pursuant to 19.2-295.2.
Okay, stop. So a period of post-release supervision. No sentence. No potential. I mean, okay.
I mean, if your client hypothetically had violated the terms of his suspended sentence and had the entire amount executed, he would still have, upon his release, he would still be subject to 3 years of post-release supervision pursuant to this order that was entered in this case. The problem is there'd be nothing left hanging over his head to enforce that. That's Judge Decker's point.
And I think when you look colloquially at post-release supervision, when that's used, when we go back, what's used in the circuit court, that's the phrase that's used. And that does necessarily encompass it.
But that's not what the General Assembly has said in the statute. The fact that it's thrown around fairly frequently and used generically doesn't support what's actually in the statute. I know it's not in your client's benefit for to talk about this extra time that has to be hanging over them, but that's really what this boils down to. You have the supervision, but nothing there if it's violated.
That would be illogical to have no meat to support, to have no teeth to it.
You're absolutely correct.
We agree.
The order is what we see. I mean, frankly, as you know, we see defective orders all the time where the order doesn't comply with a mandatory statutory requirement, and to that extent, they may be annulled. So, you know, your client, I guess, I'm not sure whether this benefits or hurts your client, but. You know, from an abstract, it seems to me it benefits him because he's got nothing to worry about. He can ignore every one of those post-release supervision conditions, whether they're imposed by the parole board or the circuit court, and there's nothing anybody can do about it, not the parole board and not the circuit court, because there's nothing hanging over his head.
Certainly not based on these orders.
I'd like to reserve the rest of time for it, but unless there's a specific question in there that I can answer.
No, and we've given you a lot to think about, so we're going to give you 2 minutes on rebuttal.
That's a gift. Thank you.
Mr. Jeffrey, I hope you've been paying attention. Come on up and...
Tell us where
come
we're
on at. Down.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm on the upside of this, if you go that direction, or the downside.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe you guys can switch seats at some point here.
Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. You know, obviously the thing the court has pointed to is not something we argued. I think it's incumbent on me to point out, although I'm sure
I have to admit, I looked at, you know, in trying to make sense of all these different statutes, I stumbled across 18.2-10, and the language there is very specific.
And I'm sorry, that's the one I didn't bring with me, Judge. Could you read that provision
sure,
to me again? I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
I have 295.2, but I don't have that one in front of me.
We've thrown you guys off a bit, so. I'm going to let Judge Humphreys do it because he's better on the computer than I am.
Here it is. For any felony offense committed on or after July 1st, 2000, the court shall impose an additional term of not less than 6 months. Impose an additional term of not less than 6 months nor more than 3 years, which shall be suspended conditioned upon successful completion of a period of post-release supervision pursuant to 19.2-295.2 and compliance with such other terms and conditions as the court may require. However, such additional term may only be imposed when the sentence includes an active term of incarceration in a correctional facility. Now, 19.2-295.2, and this is why I had to, you know, try to make sense of all this, strictly talks about post-release supervision. Doesn't mention the additional term. It permits the court to impose it and to set conditions along with the parole board. And so trying to figure out who is doing what here, who's on first, you know, I looked at 18.2-10 and I looked at the order and noticed that the order, despite the fact the order had been corrected at some point, still didn't provide for any additional term of incarceration. So my question, as Judge Decker alluded to earlier, we don't typically issue advisory opinions. And so how would this be anything other than that if there's no consequences to be gleaned from any of this?
Well, and I will say this, Your Honor, and maybe I'm missing something. I think what you're pointing to in 18.2-10 is consistent with 295.2A because it says such additional term shall be suspended and the defendant placed under post-release supervision upon release from the active term of incarceration. So,
But this order simply doesn't impose any additional time. I mean, that's the problem.
It does not. It doesn't do that. I mean, the sort of quandary here is obviously everyone treated it as if it were implicit. And here, you've got more than that, as the court's aware. And I don't know where this leaves you in all of this mess, because the trial judge who ultimately revoked here declined to enter a non-proton order, but it's very clear, I think it's the very last page of the joint appendix, when the original sentencing judge imposed this, she said that she was imposing post-release supervision. The court will suspend for 3 years upon the condition. She clearly intended for it to operate that
but
way.
But don't you have to, I mean, doesn't this throw the old courts speak through their orders on their head, on its head? And, you know, we recognize, I mean, all of these statutes have to be read together. And I will give both of you kudos for parsing through all of the various things because, frankly, some of them are not well written in terms of getting an understanding of how all this works. But clearly this was all, you know, abolition of parole, post-abolition of parole. They're trying to set up a system. And so, you know, the question becomes, all right, so there's no suspended sentence on this time. They're going to serve the active time, but we want to still supervise. So how do you do that? Well, you have to have this fake 6 month to 3 year thing hanging over their head, or else there's no motivation to do whatever it is that's being imposed upon them. And when you've got an order that does the one part but doesn't do the other part, how do you deal with that?
You know, I was looking at this when the court started asking appellant's counsel these questions, and I think, although we can only speculate, I think that the trial judge was, and I'm talking about the one who ultimately revoked, on pages 63 and 64, appeared on the brink of saying that I think it's implicit when you cite 295.2, because it would be almost nonsensical to just have that provision. Now, and I will say, and I don't know where this leaves us, because but the Commonwealth below, page 41 of the joint appendix, and I've got an end quote here, talks about the supervision means nothing if you don't have that term. And the Commonwealth otherwise the supervision means nothing. She's saying essentially that it's implicit. And in light of what you raised, Judge Humphreys, I don't know if you're dealing with a situation where this is void. We clearly don't have a right to appeal.
Here's what I think. And this is pure just educated speculation on my part, but I think what's going on here is the General Assembly was at least smart enough to consider two possibilities, neither of which apply here. One is a situation where an individual is sentenced to an active term of incarceration with nothing suspended.
Your classic jury situation. People coming out on the back end of those, and there was no way to pull them back into the system. They're back on the streets immediately. Exactly. That was clearly the beginning of this.
Exactly. And then the other situation, which is also not quite what we have here, is a situation where a sentence is imposed, part of it is suspended, not all of it, and the individual is placed on supervised probation with terms and conditions for the suspended sentence that he has to comply with. And, of course, during the period of that suspended sentence that's part of the active sentence, if he violates the terms and conditions, then any portion or all of the suspended portion of the sentence can be executed. But the statute still requires that if you are incarcerated for any period of time more than 6 months, the court has to impose this additional post-release supervision requirement, which includes additional time, if you will, to hang over their head. So what we have here is a situation where the court suspended part of the sentence, not all of it. The individual was incarcerated. The court partially followed the law by imposing a period of post-release supervision, but not imposing any additional time. And I guess everybody assumed that, well, you know, it would be part of the terms and conditions of the suspended sentence as opposed to the post-release supervision, and that, you know, that I guess that it was never contemplated the individual would actually serve all of their time and then need to be dealt with in terms of post-release supervision. So, you know, and maybe, I don't know how often that happens, but clearly that's not the situation the General Assembly contemplated. You know, it only makes sense, I think, if you conclude that they wanted a way to encourage people to remain of good behavior at least for some period of time after they've served what amounts to their entire sentence.
I'm looking at the original sentencing order. This was the scenario. I was just trying to refresh my memory to make sure I remembered it correct. As far as the original sentence, there was three. If I'm reading it correctly, there was 3 years active imposed, and none of that was suspended. We had
that's
post-release supervision, and I think by statute, Judge Humphreys, I'd have to go back to 295.2. If you've got 6 months or more of suspension, you don't have to impose the post-release supervision. But, I mean, that's what you have here. The court cited...
I think it's less than 6 months, actually.
That sounds...
But none of it was suspended.
There was not a suspended sentence imposed. That's
right.
Correct. The sentence on the underlying charges, there were 3 years of active time imposed, and none of that was suspended. Consistent with the statute, and obviously there's some dispute about this, but assuming that you think it's implied just by citing 295.2... there was that term of post-release supervision of 3 years imposed, which, as the court has correctly pointed out...
But let's stop a minute.
Okay.
All right, so let's assume that that's implied by citing the statute. You still don't know whether it's 6 months to 3 years. I mean, you don't know where it falls in that.
In terms of...
Not just by reading the order.
In terms of the suspended piece?
In terms of the hanging over their head, right. Because there's a range.
There is a range, and my assumption on that statute, and I think most courts write it this way, and the fundamental flaw, maybe this court didn't, you don't impose 50% on a situation like this. You don't say, I'm going to suspend this for a year, but your post-release supervision is maintained for three. I don't know that that's consistent with statute, and it may be something that some courts do, and it maybe arguably wouldn't violate the statute. But I mean,
we just can't guess.
No, I don't think you can. You know, and one of the dilemmas that I have here, I think, is that the Commonwealth's attorney below treated this as an implied three-year thing.
They all did. Everybody.
Everybody did. The court did, and you know, does that foreclose me from jumping onto this argument? I don't know the answer to that. You know, I'd suggest that there obviously, as far as orders being void in terms of sentences or whatever.
Well, I mean, the order doesn't say anything about incarceration. It just says the defendant shall be subject to a period of post-release supervision for 3 years. So all that means is he's going to be supervised for 3 years. There's no penalty, or at least we don't know what the penalty would be if he, you know, didn't follow the terms and conditions set by either the court or the parole board.
And based on Ms. French's assignment of error, you know, she's not arguing about the supervision. She's arguing about the reimposing of the sentence. So
I mean, we're in a situation where the parole board kind of tossed the ball to the circuit court saying, we don't know what to do, you guys figure it out. And I guess our position here is asking both of you, who cares, since there's nothing anybody can do about it?
Yeah, because the circuit court took the ball and ran with it.
Right.
But to what end?
Well, and maybe that moves back into the mootness piece of this. I mean, obviously that's not a component.
Well, interestingly, let's talk about the mootness. You know, there's Ms. French's argument about the court costs and other things, and you know, you're aware of Silwa up in the Supreme
More
Court.
Simple.
But in Silwa, the Commonwealth conceded. I mean, the whole Mr. Sandoval in the companion Silwa case conceded that it was not moot.
In the companion Silwa case, I think that is true. It's not in the actual opinion, from the court, but I'm aware that's what happened.
And what's the difference between the one that's sitting up in the Supreme Court where allegedly the Court of Appeals and is probably going to get spanked again, but, you know, so you're making a point now that it's moot, which is inconsistent with the Silwa unpublished opinion, which of course is not binding, but with the other Silwa up in the Supreme Court, we can only presume. I'm just a little confused.
You could write a long brief on that mootness point. I think the difference is this, that the Supreme Court of Virginia has now taken that case and granted on a presumptively correct judgment of this court that was moot, and that issue is going to be decided. It's I think it's still a live issue.
And what's the Commonwealth's position? Are you aware of what the Commonwealth's position is in Silwa that's in the Supreme Court?
The appellee's brief has not been filed yet.
Okay.
I would have to get into work product. And
To be honest with you,
even if I were to get into work product, I'd really be speculating because that there is a lot of deliberation about what our position is going to be. But suffice it to say, when we briefed this, we were aware of Silwa.
So there is a live issue in the Supreme Court. We know that.
There is as of this time. I mean, if the court, our brief is due before the end of this month. If the court wants me to update the court on what position we take in that, it may well be consistent with the other Silwa case. What you're talking about is that we may concede, which of course the Supreme Court's not bound by. The Supreme Court could snatch
right.
that and say you're wrong. I will say, and I could write a long brief on this, but I think we probably would be best off to litigate that in Silwa and just step back from it. I don't think that issue.
We've got enough to talk about in this case.
Yeah, well, that's true. You know, I will tell you this, and I can unpack this some more, and I gave Ms. French some of these cases I'm talking about. I'm not convinced that issue is as clear as we initially thought in the second Silwa case. I will leave you with that.
Oh, I'm not convinced either.
And that was certainly something that entered into our mind when we were writing this brief and preparing for argument. And I have to be perfectly honest, I've been through the U.S. Supreme Court cases on this. I've been through the Virginia Supreme Court cases. And I've got some things that in my own mind I can't reconcile and come to the point where I can say there's a clear answer to this.
Well, as far as this issue is concerned, I mean, I think clearly at some point this court is going to need to address the confusion about the parole board versus the circuit court in terms of who can do what with post-release supervision.
Yeah.
I just question whether this is the case we could do that in, given the posture of it.
You may well be correct. I see I'm getting close to running out of time. I'll say a couple of things on that point, Judge Humphreys. I feel somewhat constrained based on the way the Commonwealth treated this below and what the effect of those implicit or perhaps express concessions would be. I am aware that the nunk-pro-tunk order was denied and there wasn't an appeal on that issue, but I know what the judge said from the bench, and that issue is floating around here. And I guess the last thing I'll leave you with is my time is running out. When this case hit my desk, one of the first things I thought is, you know, like so many cases, that, and the court sees these, you know, why are people getting fancy with this? We've got it. We've got a statute that says clearly the parole board can do this, and for some reason, everybody decided it would be a good idea to take this to circuit court. I guess what I'm saying in response to what you said, Judge Humphrey, is I don't know that this is there's going to be a groundswell of Commonwealth attorneys taking these things into circuit court, no matter what you do with this case, but you may be right as well.
I can't speak for Commonwealth attorneys any longer, but anything that makes moral work for them, I suspect, is not something they're going to want to do.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Jeffrey. So from a standpoint of your, because we've taken you, both of you, completely off the merits arguments, from a standpoint of the law, can the parole board revoke a suspended sentence?
That was my understanding of the statute. I think they have the ability under, I think it's 53.1136. I didn't pull my notes back.
Well, and the interesting thing is both you and Ms. French cited, you know, whether you can have concurrent or exclusive as in the code. You both did an excellent job on brief. I just was curious if, so your position is concurrent.
My position is that the parole board definitely has it, that it is concurrent based on what's in the other statutes. The only other thing that I would leave you with, if the court will indulge me another 30 seconds, is that, you know, obviously we both put these statutory construction arguments out there. There's statutes that say concurrent, there's statutes that say exclusive, but this is a liberal construction case. I made that point on brief, first of all, and second of all, plain language of the statutes governs under any statutory construction principle. So I think, you know, any connecting all those dots, I think that's ultimately where this case goes. I had a big line of U.S. Supreme Court cases talking about how, you know, the fact that there are synonyms used, I mean, maybe you use exclusive jurisdiction sometimes, maybe you don't in others, but if you get to the same place, that doesn't defeat. You don't then say, oh, well, they didn't use those exact words in the second statute, so we can't find its exclusive. That's clearly not true. If you want those cites, I'll give them to you.
If the presiding judge will indulge you, what would be the rationale for having concurrent jurisdiction? I mean, it seems to me, you know, at least arguably the thinking of the General Assembly might be, well, with post-release supervision, the circuit court has finished with the guy, they served their sentence, you know, or all their time has been executed or whatever. And the only body that arguably is left that, you know, deal with an individual who's been let out of prison and who's entirely served their sentence would logically be the parole board.
I think two things. I mean, the first thing I'm going to say in response to that, Judge Humphreys, is that, you know, when you have plain meaning under the statutes, we don't really have that policy debate at this level, I don't believe. But I think, second of all, it provides an alternative where a defendant could get more process than the parole board would provide, and they may have thought that if the Commonwealth's attorney thinks that's appropriate, that they would do it there. And circuit courts superintend any other type of suspended sentence, so it's not a leap to think that they were okay with that, but there is that parole board option. That's maybe a more feeble answer than I wanted to give you, but I guess the flip side is I don't think that the General Assembly would think it was weird to have these coming into court either. But mostly I'm relying on the plain language of those statutes that talk about suspended sentences. That's kind of where I am. And our courts have many times said, you know, sometimes you may question the policy decisions that you make, and maybe you can't even completely unpack that. But nonetheless, in the light of the plain language of the statute, that the jurisdiction does lie concurrently, that would be our position.
Thank you, Mr. Jeffrey.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. French, we're giving you an extra 2 minutes.
Thank you.
So I'm not sure if you'll be happy with that or not, but go ahead.
No, I'm happy with that. First, I just want to make clear that the assignment of error covers both the post-release supervision and the revoking the post-release incarceration. I believe it covers both just by the plain language of the assignment of error. Second thing, going back to the main conversation today, I think that we need to keep in mind principle of law that statutes can't be read in a way that produces an absurd result. That regardless of the plain meaning, regardless of whether or not, you know, it's ambiguous, all of that, that second layer is whether or not there's an absurdity. And believe that if you read it as that they don't work together, that you can only give a period of post-release supervision, and that doesn't encompass a period of incarceration, then that is absurd, because to give a defendant...
Well, how do we discern what the period of incarceration is here?
3 years. Because if it's implicit, the argument is that it's implicit, give a period of post-release supervision of 3 years, that...
Why would we automatically conclude that that was the, would be the punishment for violence? In other words, hypothetically, under the statute, a court could impose 6 months and then 3 years of post-release supervision. In other words, 6 months incarceration, suspended condition upon 3 years post-release supervision. Why would we automatically conclude from the 3 years post-release supervision that that means 3 years incarceration as well?
Because my argument is that they're basically in tandem. They're the same, so that if you impose 3 years of post-release supervision without explicitly... I think that the court can explicitly do what you're suggesting, but if it's silent on the matter, it then goes to 3 years.
Yeah, but how do you get there? How do you say that?
And also, is this a penal statute that we construe strictly against the Commonwealth?
It's a penal statute.
So we would construe it strictly against the Commonwealth in favor of your client, which seems to undercut your argument.
For Mr. Eggleston, his argument is that that the both are in tandem, and it would be absurd to put someone on post-release supervision, but say, go report, and if you don't follow, well, there's absolutely no consequences at all. Just ignore everything
Well, but trial judges, I mean, those kind of errors exist periodically where the judge either misreads a statute or doesn't do exactly what a statute says, and the order doesn't reflect that. That doesn't mean it's an absurd result of our reading of the statute or of the court's reading of the statute. It's just an error on the part of the trial judge. They inadvertently did not put in the order.
I don't think that the trial court might answer the question.
Yes, please do.
That the trial court made a mistake here. I don't think that there was a mistake in assuming that they're part and parcel, that they're together. I believe the statutes can be read in tandem, and that it would be absurd to give someone supervision and they could just disregard during that entire time period of supervision without having any consequences.
But that's why the period of time is there.
So if we had a sentencing order, if you'll indulge me, if we had a sentencing order that neglected to impose a sentence but put an individual on probation for 3 years, under your analysis, we would assume the court meant to impose a three-year sentence.
No. Probation is totally different than post-release supervision.
You almost said that with a straight face, too.
That's totally different than post-release supervision. I do think that there is a big difference between probation.
I won't beat that horse anymore.
All right. Well, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The next, we're coming down to Greece.